This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us. It's time for Trumpet Hour's Week in Review. Our panel of writers from the Trumpet, we're ready to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
We also have Anthony Chabotterway.
Hello.
And from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
So we're going to start the program today with the aftermath of the school shooting in Parkland, Florida last week. The story this week is these students who are demanding changes to the gun control laws in the United States. For this story, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is really a building movement in Florida and across the nation. We were getting students meeting in protest and in town hall meetings. And you can find some of the video clips on YouTube and or other news sources about people that really have some sincere grief over the Parkland shooting and are demanding action. And they're demanding action now. Mm-hmm. And they're starting to get some support from some pretty high places. We haven't heard a ton from former President Barack Obama since he's left office, but he's waded back into the national discussion now.
He kind of picks his spots. This one is hard for him to resist.
He came in for climate change after the Paris Accord and then went quiet for a while. And then he's coming back for gun control, where he tweeted this week that young people have helped lead all our great movements. How inspiring to see it again. So many smart, fearless students standing up for the right to be safe, marching and organizing to remake the world as it should be. And then later on he said, we've been waiting for you and we've got your backs. So he's definitely supporting this movement for gun reform laws.
A fact check might be in order on that tweet.
Yeah, I don't know. All our great movements. I didn't see many 17-year-olds at the Constitutional Convention, but or some of the...
So of course, Andrew was there.
President Obama is definitely joining forces with a lot of powerful voices that are supporting what these young people are doing and saying.
Right, because, I mean, obviously the young people, they've gone through a great tragedy, and they're really emotional about this, and rightly so in a lot of ways. They don't think they know explicitly what they want as far in terms of gun control reform, but there's definitely some politicians who've jumped in there with their ideas on what they want. Dianne Feinstein from California is one who's been really trying to push an assault weapons ban, not at the state level, but at the federal level, congressional level. There's a few legal issues with that, is that the Second Amendment prohibits Congress from making a law infringing on gun ownership rights. States can do it, but the federal government, and many states have, but the federal government has some limitations there that the states don't. And the issue over exactly what an assault weapon is kind of sticky. It basically comes down to anything that looks kind of like an AR-15. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama's tried to define it as anything that can shoot more than 10 rounds. They did an assault weapons ban in 1994 under the Bill Clinton administration, which didn't help much just because normal hunting rifles can do a lot of the same things that some of these assault rifles can do.
Yeah, so it is interesting. These are the types of things that are being overlooked, the facts that are being overlooked in favor of these highly emotional appeals by young people, by high school students, to do something. And they're talking very strongly, like, well, whatever it is, it's got to. This is all because of government inaction. It's amazing to me how a crazed high school student could walk into a school, shoot up a bunch of kids, and this is Congress's fault. Like all of the anger is being directed toward the leaders in Washington.
Right, and that's the tricky part in this this recent situation, is that the local authorities haven't yet told us how Nicholas Cruz got his weapon. So I don't know if he did it legally or illegally, because, as I said, even assuming you could ban all legal sales of assault weapons or military-style assault weapons. There are 300 million guns floating around the United States.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also relevant that only about 100 of the 30,000 annual gun homicides are committed with so-called assault weapons. So it's just a tiny fraction of a fraction.
Right. According to the FBI statistics, murder is committed most by knives, shotguns, blunt objects, bare hands, and then assault weapons, or what are considered assault weapons.
Right. So banning anything that can shoot more than 10 rounds is mostly trying to not cut down on murder itself, but cut down on these mass shootings.
So in spite of, say, some of the facts that we're talking about, and obviously legitimate concerns that, say, what these students are suggesting doesn't have practical application in terms of actually moving the needle on reducing these kinds of incidents, you have this, not just President Obama, but what strikes me is how much the press has gotten behind this. I was just looking for some headlines. The Boston Globe headline, "For this teachable moment, let the children lead the lesson." CNN has an article by Van Jones that says, "A children's crusade Jesus would be proud of." I'll just read a little bit of this article. "The answers seem to lie in an unlikely place with our children. The children of Parkland, Florida are leading and people are listening. Jesus would be proud. Our children, as much as they receive our professions of love, have not always received our respect. In Jesus's time, children had very little status. Yet when his disciples were turning away the children and not allowing them to come receive blessings, Jesus said, 'Let the little children come to me and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these.'" I want to just play a short clip from a highly publicized rally of young people in Florida. This is a student from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. This is actually from Time Magazine's website.
"Congress, why does my 10-year-old brother need to know how to protect himself from being murdered? Dear Congress, why am I afraid to send my 10-year-old brother to school?"
So this is the wisdom of the young people that we need to be listening to. This is what lawmakers are supposed to treat as with the utmost respect. And certainly CNN is, Time Magazine, all of these mainstream sources, they're treating it with the utmost respect. MSNBC reporter who tweeted about breaking news: students are in the waiting area of Florida Governor Rick Scott's office after being told he's too busy to meet with them, chanting, "Shame on you." All of these students outside the Florida governor's office, "Shame on you, shame on you," because, you know, he's too busy to meet with his constituents. He's not going to talk to the survivors of this school shooting in his own state. Just a terrible optics here, and MSNBC is tweeting this out. It was discovered that after, you know, over 3,000 retweets on this MSNBC tweet, the reason why the governor was gone was because he was at a victim's funeral. They didn't bother to check that out before shouting at him and publicizing this and so on. Again, there's no facts. It's just wild reporting and unbridled emotion.
Right. The problems are real. The emotions are real. The question is, what do you do about it? And like I said, they're looking for quick and easy solutions. Like, well, just to ban assault rifles. That hasn't necessarily done a ton to help in the past. 54% of Americans don't think it's going to help at all if we ban assault rifles. And even more, 58% think that even if we did, they can't trust the government to implement those types of bans fairly. Mm-hmm. And that does really get down to, I guess, some of the crux for the issue on the other side. As I know, China weighed in on it as well, saying that America needs to institute gun bans like they have gun bans because their crime rate is lower than our crime rate, assuming you stay away from soldiers in Tiananmen Square. Which is kind of gets back to, I mean, America and particularly, I mean, George III tried to take guns away from the people of Boston in the 1770s. Just kind of something in our culture, it made it just kind of just really worried about things like Tiananmen Square or Lexington and Concord, that as soon as you don't have a weapon, government tyranny becomes a real possibility as well. And that is something that in his book, America Under Attack by Mr. Gerald Fleury, he's got a section there on the reason for the Second Amendment. We gave this right to the states. I mean, it's not to say that just everybody has an inalienable right to be able to hold whatever military-style assault weapon they can get their hands on. But the states do have a right to make their own laws regulating what types of guns are okay to hold and what kinds aren't, just as like a guarantee that if an Adolf Hitler or Mao Zedong ever tried to rise to power here, the people have a failsafe to protect themselves against that.
Well, these arguments are obviously going back and forth and will continue to go back and forth. I guess the thing that stands out to me in this case is just how much the left is trying to use this moment, you know, never let a crisis go to waste kind of a mindset to push this issue forward. And the way that they're politicizing the anger of these young people and they're publicizing it, the way that these media outlets are publicizing this, it really does show just how partisan it is.
Yeah, Daniel Hannan has made a few points about this with regard to UK law, where he points out generally the worst laws are ones that have people's names attached to them. You know, like Sally's Law, or I can't remember the specific ones that are done in response to a tragedy, because laws drafted in emotion, in kind of the heat of the moment, usually end up being bad because they're not thought through. It's just like in a court, you wouldn't have the victim of a crime be the one to go track down the criminal and bring them to justice or something like that. You kind of have this sense, well, we need to set emotion aside and deal with this problem rationally. Mm-hmm. And it's often the same in something like this. But not only have you got no effort to kind of sit and think, okay, let's deal with this rationally, let's not strike out of some kind of emotion, but it's just a, well, let's churn the emotion. Let's play clips like the one that we heard earlier with people screaming. Let's do all that we can to just whip up as many people as we can into an emotional fervor.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and to think that, say, the wisdom, quote unquote, that you would get from grieving young people would exceed that of America's founding fathers when they implemented the Second Amendment, it's just really absurd. And the other thing that just strikes me as phenomenal is the inconsistencies in the left's point of view. Here at this point, we're hearing these arguments that, well, we need to raise the age when you can get a gun up beyond up to 21. You know, no one under 21 should be able to get a gun. At the same time, that we're saying, well, we need to trust young people who can't be trusted with guns to determine our gun control laws. You know, at the same time that we're hearing, like, overall, the argument that we're hearing over and over again is that, and Stephen Fleury talked about this morning on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, is that police forces are inherently racist. We can't trust them. Well, now the story is that they're the only ones that we can trust. You know, they're the only ones that are going to keep us safe, and that no one else should have a gun other than these law enforcement officers. And as he brought out, the story came out this morning that the policeman who was on the scene in this particular case, he didn't enter the building. There was a guy inside shooting people up for several minutes, and he's standing outside allowing this to go on for 4 minutes. These are the people that supposedly Americans are supposed to entrust with their safety. You know, it really is amazing just how inconsistent the views are. It is important to note that we're not saying that the solution to this is everybody needs more guns, that we need to do away with all gun bans or that type of thing. The fact is that the way, and Stephen Fleury brought this out, he quoted his dad saying this on a Key of David program, that all of this effort to address this, it's not even trying to get to the cause of the problem. It's dealing with the effects, and it's dealing with the effects in some really ineffective ways. But the causes, like we were talking about last week with, you know, drug use, the way that we're drugging our young people, the way that we've fractured the family to the point where you have kids who aren't being raised correctly. They're raised without fathers and so on. These are causes. And it's not even a word about those aspects of it in as far as the mainstream conversation goes. It's just about, you know, well, we need to pass more laws, as if passing a law is going to remove guns from the hands of people who are actually willing to go out and shoot up and take lives by the dozens. These are people who aren't under law. These are people who are outside the law. You could take away guns from, you know, millions of law-abiding citizens, and you would still have people finding ways to, you know, if they wanted to do it, they would find ways to commit mayhem. So again, the dealing with the causes of it really has to be at the heart of the discussion about it. The other thing about this, it just makes me think of the verses in Isaiah 3 where it says, "I'll give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over him. The child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient, the base against the honorable." I'd say it's probably a pretty major theme in history that you have young people who are upset at the older people for maybe ruining the world that they're growing up in, and saying, "Well, you have failed us, and we need to take charge, and we need to set the rules ourselves." That's not that atypical. I guess it's the way it's being amplified and the way it's being promulgated today, and the way you have, you know, mainstream news sources that are taking what these children are saying and broadcasting it the way that they are. It just recalls those prophecies to mind. "For me, as for my people, children are their oppressors. You know, they which lead you cause you to err and destroy the way of your paths." To me, those prophecies have really come to greater life in light of what's happening this week. Well, thanks for that discussion, gentlemen. That was very invigorating. We're going to move on to news elsewhere in the world, starting with Asia. A mishap in Japan has added fuel to Japanese opposition to America's military presence in that country. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this was on Tuesday morning, and an American F-16 fighter jet dumped two fuel tanks into a lake that was full of fishermen near Misawa Air Base, and that's in northern Japan. There was apparently an engine fire that broke out just after this U.S. pilot took off, so he jettisoned these tanks for safety reasons, and then he was able to return to the base, and no one was injured in this incident, but the Japanese are still quite upset about it. The lake where these tanks were dropped is a popular fishing destination. There were plenty of fishing boats out at the time when these tanks fell, some of them just a few hundred feet away. And also, these tanks carry about 1,400 liters each of fuel. So fishing in this lake has had to be suspended until the water can be tested and deemed safe. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe there in Japan, he's spoken out pretty vociferously about this. He has called on the U.S. to tighten up its safety measures. And if this were the only incident like this to have happened, mm-hmm. it really wouldn't be very noteworthy. But this is just the latest in a long list of military accidents and incidents involving U.S. military aircraft stationed in Japan. Mm-hmm. Last month in January, there were three separate times when U.S. helicopters had to do emergency landings in Okinawa. And then in December, there was a window that fell out of a U.S. helicopter onto a playground of a school in Okinawa. So it's been a long string of mishaps, those sorts of things. And also in the last several years, there have been incidents of crime committed by U.S. service personnel against Japanese citizens. Some of these have been the worst kinds of crimes you can imagine, including rape and murder.
And those have been more highly reported than some of these more technical things.
Yes, much more highly reported, because obviously it's not an accident. I mean, these are egregious crimes that are done with purpose.
U.S. soldiers and sailors misbehaving and, right. and creating havoc in the area.
Yeah, so you take all this together, though, and it is adding up to make a great deal of opposition to the U.S. military presence in Japan.
And it's happening at the same time that, say, in some ways, we've been seeing America's presence in Asia challenged in other ways, Japan expressing a certain amount of concern whether they can really trust the United States to have their back in security guarantees against other Asian threats. And this rising nationalism in Japan. There's quite a lot of storylines, strands that are factoring into this that are maybe creating a bit of a divide between Japan and the United States.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Japan's military is on the fast track right now to normalization. You know, they're very soon to be a full-fledged military power who would no longer have any need for U.S. security backing. And when you see that trend happening concomitantly with this trend of the U.S. kind of making mistakes, it just adds a lot of fuel to the movement for the Japanese to normalize and to get rid of the U.S. and just to be, you know, a military power in their own right.
So put it in context for us. How realistic would it be for Japan to kick the United States out, and what kind of loss would that be to America's military?
Well, if it were up to the people of Okinawa, which is where the overwhelming majority of U.S. troops are stationed, the U.S. would have been gone yesterday, last year. But Japan as a whole is still fairly divided on the issue. They're concerned about North Korea. They're concerned about China. And having the U.S. there has helped Japan to become very wealthy because they haven't had to spend a whole lot on their military and security. Most polls show that many Japanese still feel kind of a need for the U.S. to be there. But as we talked about, as Japan's own military continues to normalize and become more powerful, we will begin to see that support for the U.S. presence eroding. And it will be quite a loss for the U.S. We have about 50,000 military personnel stationed in Japan right now, and it's a major pillar of America's presence in Asia. And the U.S. presence there is vital to America's efforts to be able to contain China, to be able to keep the South China Sea and East China Seas kind of freely flowing for world trade and shipping. And even for us to be able to keep an eye on Russia right there. You know, it's part of our international kind of strategy of being able to monitor those powers that are present the most danger to the international order. So if Japan kicks America out, it would be pretty catastrophic for the U.S., especially with the so-called pivot to Asia strategy that the U.S. has been pursuing.
So the United States' weakening ties with Asia and Japan's rising militarism, these are two trends that we've been talking about for quite some time. What has the Trumpet said about this, and really even the plain truth before us?
Yes, about 50 years ago, the Plain Truth magazine, with Herbert W. Armstrong as its editor-in-chief, warned that U.S. influence in Japan would not last. I've got a quote from the April 1968 issue that says, "Despite popular belief, Japan is not permanently committed to a pro-Western position. America has foolishly followed the policy of assuming that Japan can be converted to the virtues of democracy in less than a generation. But Japan tolerates her present form of government only as long as it is economically expedient. If the time were ever to come, and it will come, that the Japanese could not feed off of American aid, we would witness a remarkable change in attitude toward the U.S. Friendship would quickly evaporate." So that was 1968. And at the time that that was written, Japan was almost entirely dependent on the U.S. Mm-hmm. They were still rebuilding after being crushed in World War II. But now, though, especially with this recent spate of incidents with U.S. Military aircraft, and since Japan has come such a long way in becoming a full-fledged military power, now it's pretty easy to envision a scenario in which Japan decides to go it alone and stop hosting those 50,000 U.S. military personnel. And Bible prophecy shows, especially in Ezekiel chapter 38, that in the end-time war that is very close to breaking out right now, Japan will not be partnered with the United States, but with Russia and with China. So these prophecies were recorded thousands of years ago, but today we really see the groundwork for those being laid for their fulfillment.
Somebody wants more information, where would you send them?
I would send them to our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy. There's a whole chapter in there about Japan and how Japan, as difficult as it may be to see now with its present alliance with the U.S., it will be part of that Russia-China axis.
You can find that booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, for free on thetrumpet.com. You can read it online or ask for a copy. We'll send it to you for free. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. Well, it's official. In a sign of just how dramatically the political scene in Germany is shifting, there is a new number two political party. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
That's right. Germany's alternative for Deutschland, this party that has only really emerged in the last few years, for the first time in any poll ever, is now Germany's number two party. Meanwhile, the Social Democratic Party, Germany's oldest political party in what's currently in parliament, its main left-wing party, is now in third place. So this is a dramatic turnaround, really, for both parties now. And this is just the latest of a whole series of events that have caused people to really wonder about what is going on with German politics, and, you know, starting to talk more and more about a major political crisis here.
All right, Richard, for the person who hasn't been watching thetrumpet.com, who hasn't been listening to Trumpet Hour, give the Reader's Digest version of why the shift, why such a dramatic political shift, and what the alternative for Deutschland's rise really tells you about Germany.
Well, a lot of it is in the name, alternative. Germany at least the last government has been ruled in a coalition between the main left-wing and the main right-wing party, and it looks like they're heading for that way again. It just kind of people feel like, well, whoever you vote for, you end up with this vague middle ground position that lets in migrants, and they want something else. And they want a growing number want leaders that will stand up for Germany.
So would you say like the migrant issue, is that kind of top of the list?
Yes, I think so. The alternative for Deutschland started but over disagreement on the euro crisis and economic policy, but it only really picked up steam with the migrant crisis.
Mm-hmm. So why is this such a concern? What is it that we're looking for, say, the shift in German politics from a prophetic standpoint, why that would be something we're watching closely?
So the rise of the AfD, it shows a whole lot of dissatisfaction within Germany, that people are abandoning parties, that people are actually willing to turn in very large numbers for a party that would usually be completely stigmatized in Germany. That when you look at some of the things that the politicians, their leaders have said would kind of be a complete outcast from normal, polite society, and that is less and less the case now. So they're willing to turn to this party that's come from nowhere, that would once be beyond the pale. Now, we're not saying that the AfD is going to come and take over Germany or anything like that, but the support for the AfD is an excellent barometer for dissatisfaction within Germany. This dissatisfaction, it goes well beyond AfD voters. You've got the Left Party, that is another political party that's really radical, the leftovers of Germany's East Communist regime, really every bit as radical as the AfD is on the right, but they're on the left. So they're on, I think, around 12-13%. So about 30%, one third of Germans going for radical parties. You're going to have way more that kind of agree with what the AfD think or agree with the left party, but for tactical reasons or other reasons, they want to stick with the mainstream parties. So you're starting to see this groundswell where you've got perhaps even the majority in Germany, not just unhappy, but unhappy to a degree that is going to, you know, change lifelong voting patterns, do things they would have never considered doing before. So it's that dissatisfaction that we're watching in Germany, because the Bible talks about major political changes within Germany, and that dissatisfaction could be a huge driver of it. And the Bible talks about a new strong leader coming in Germany. What do you need for a strong leader to come? What makes people want a strong leader to get rid of political norms and bring in a strong leader? Well, they have to be really unhappy with the way things are right now. And so prophecies like Daniel chapter 8, Daniel chapter 11, they talk about that strong leader. And that's where this dissatisfaction is leading, to that strong leader.
Yeah, I do wonder, too, now that it's the second biggest political party in Germany, if just mathematically speaking, the Christian Democratic Union won't have to include them on a coalition sometime in the future. I know Angela Merkel would never go for that, but if someone else included them in a minority partner as a coalition, like you said, it doesn't seem likely that the AfD would ever take over Germany just because they're anti-Euro, anti-European Union, and that's not what the Bible predicts is going to happen to Germany. But as a junior coalition partner, they could shift a right-wing coalition in a much more anti-Islam, anti-immigrant direction.
Yeah, absolutely. Because when you look at, say, just even the, like you said, the mathematics of it, when you have extreme parties getting 30% of the vote, in East Germany, 40% of the vote, if you're a company that goes with coalitions, how do you exclude them? You know, it's kind of like either every other party gets together in a coalition, mm-hmm. or you have to bring either the extreme right or the extreme left to govern with you.
So, Richard, you mentioned these prophecies. Where would you direct people to learn more about where we're looking for this to head?
Well, we've got our free booklet, A Strong German Leader. It seems like we're kind of almost plugging this every week on the show, but it is, I mean, that is the key to understanding Germany right now, are these prophecies. And in that book, A Strong German Leader is imminent. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory goes through those prophecies, you know, shows the news and where they've been fulfilled already, and where this is taking Germany.
All right. Thanks for that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Turmoil in the strategically important Horn of Africa is heating up in the nation of Ethiopia. For this story, we'll turn to Anthony Chibatterway.
The Ethiopian prime minister actually resigned on February 15th. And to some people, that was very shocking because he was not expected to resign until at least later this year. But for some people, it wasn't shocking because his five-year rule has been tenuous. Ethiopia has been in chaos. It's divided along multiple ethnic lines. And so it's not just a political crisis in Ethiopia. It's a social and even a religious crisis. So currently you've had a four-party coalition government that is dominated by a minority ethnic group that probably makes up about 6%, only 6% of Ethiopia. And the majority of Ethiopians have felt like they've been discriminated against by this government. And so for about 3 years now, they've been protesting against the government. And many of those protests have been violent. Many people have been killed by the government, and which also leads to more protests and more killings. So in October 2016, the government imposed a six-month state of emergency. And what happened after it expired? The government extended it 4 more months. So that just shows how bad the situation was. And on February 16, just the day after the Ethiopian prime minister resigned, the government imposed another six-month state of emergency. And the thing about these states of emergencies is that they tend to give the government even more power, more authority to clamp down on these, on its opponents. And that tends to just fuel the opposition even more. It just creates this vicious cycle. And that's what you've been seeing in Ethiopia. And that's part of what led to the resignation of the prime minister.
So put this in context for us. Why Ethiopia is so important. The position there on the Horn of Africa, there are outside powers that are basically vying for control over this area, and it seems like this kind of unrest opens the door for more outside influence. Tell us about that.
Part of that outside influence will likely depend on what's going on inside. If now that the prime minister has resigned, there are higher chances that a Muslim prime minister could take over, or at least the Muslims could gain more support and more influence in the country. And that's what some of these outside powers could capitalize on. And that's exactly what we've been watching on the Trumpet.
And just in case anyone's thinking, well, it's just us saying this, I thought I'd bring you a couple of quotes just from a Geopolitical Futures article on Ethiopia this week that confirm exactly what Anthony's saying. They write that for the second time in 2 years, Ethiopia has declared a state of emergency. Bouts of unrest have plagued Ethiopia six times since 1960. And if history is any guide, the latest crisis will get worse before it gets better. This means that for countries interested in establishing a foothold in the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia could soon be reopening for business. And they go through a list of different countries that they basically say these are the ones that could now very soon start trying to sway Ethiopia to come under their influence. So their analysis is exactly the same.
Exactly. They state that there are plenty of candidates, and Russia is one of them, the U.S., Turkey, China, India, but they also focus in on Iran. And that's a country we've been focusing on because the Bible does indicate that Iran is going to have a strong it's going to have strong ties to Ethiopia and have a strong influence in that region because it's very strategic. There's a lot of merchandise that passes through the waters around that area. And geopolitical futures, it says this, Iran also strives to have a strong presence in the region. Until recently, Iran was a patron of both Sudan and Somalia, but then Saudi Arabia paid each to switch sides and Iran lost its place. Ethiopia could be a replacement because Iran does need that influence, that control in that region. And it has lost a little bit of influence with Sudan and Somalia. And now it's trying to take advantage of this crisis in Ethiopia.
Yeah, it makes me think of what Gerald Flory has written about Iran's strategy in taking over the waterways in that area. Obviously, Ethiopia is a huge, huge component of that.
Indeed. And we have an article that's on the website right now. It's titled "Ethiopian Prime Minister Resigns During Worsening Ethnic Divisions." It's by Callum Wood. It'll explain more of what we just talked about in detail. And there is a booklet that Mr. Gerald Flory wrote. It's titled "Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy," and explains why we are watching what's happening in the region. I do expect our readers to be a lot more excited about just these prophecies, because you can just type in those names, those countries, Libya, Ethiopia, in your Bible. They pop out right away. And so this is something that will make it easier for them to watch what's happening.
Thanks for that, Anthony. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We're going to take a short break. Coming up, we'll talk about why Europeans are unhappy about the next European Commission Secretary General and more stories. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
A new man was appointed to the job of European Commission Secretary General this week, quite a powerful position, and there are some people who are unhappy about it. To learn why, we'll go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, there's a growing sense within Europe that they have a German problem, that there are too many Germans in the top jobs. That's a quote from Politico, and you can see why. So Martin Selmayr was promoted to the job of Director General of the European Commission, but then you've also got Germans in charge of the European Investment Bank, the European Stability Mechanism. You've got them in charge of the Single Resolution Board, which is another very important part of just the way the euro works. Just this week, Die Zeit had an article reporting that the Social Democrats and Angela Merkel agreed to push Jens Weidmann to be the new head of the European Central Bank. So you have this picture of just Germans everywhere. What I think is especially interesting is it's not actually Germans everywhere. It's Germans all at the top of all the finance jobs, which is there for a reason, because Germany has all the money. They're the main creditor. They control a lot of the money. They're the ones that Europe needs to keep happy, because they've got to convince them to keep paying. The best way to convince them to keep paying is to have the Germans deciding whether the purse strings are open or shut. And over time, what's that's led is to this pretty comprehensive German control of Europe's money. And you want to know how to control a bloc? You control their money. And in some ways, the Germans being in that position is a symptom rather than a cause of that. They're there because fundamentally it is Germany, the country, that's generating that cash. But it still makes it much easier for them now to steer the way that it's going. And it's an excellent illustration of just the way that Germany is at the top of the European Union.
So do you have any sense of there's kind of two storylines here. One is what these people are saying, that their Germans are taking over these positions. And the other is that they're saying it, that you have a certain amount of concern among these folks. What do you make of it? Are you just focusing kind of on the first part of it, or is there something to the second part, too?
Yeah, there's something to the second part. And I think that's why it's interesting to see France now being the one taking the lead on European reform. And Germany's quite happy for that. Everyone's talking about French reform plans. And I think a lot of it will end up being what Germany wants for some of those just fundamental reasons that it will be German money that's paying for the reform. It means that you will have Germany making an effort to be less obviously the ones in charge of everything. And as you see that, it doesn't mean that German power has gone away, but they're quite happy to let, say, France be the front man for this initiative, for example.
So Germany in the pole position here with respect to the EU, what do you make of it prophetically?
Yeah, we have our free booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, and the last chapter there goes through what is prophesied for this union, where it's leading. I mean, the Bible does have very specific prophecies about a union of 10 nations. It also has very specific prophecies about Germany being the main power within that. So our free booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, will take you through that, take you through what's prophesied. It talks a lot in that last chapter, just even about the current state of modern Germany, so you can prove that so many of those prophecies have already happened, have already been fulfilled, and then it will take you through and show you what's coming next.
All right, very good. Thanks for that, Richard. Venezuela was recently considered a socialist paradise, implementing Marxist policies that many leftists think are absolutely terrific. But conditions there continue to get worse, and Venezuelans are fleeing the country in record numbers. To learn about the extent of the crisis, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Well, the last 5 years have definitely been really, really rough on Venezuela. Like you said, it was kind of a socialist paradise for a while until they ran out of other people's money to spend. Then after a crash in the oil market, you have pretty much a state-driven oil economy that's just not making money. And so there's not even enough food to go around anymore. They recently did a survey saying the average Venezuelan has lost 24 pounds in the past 5 years. Many of them, 90% of the population is in poverty. I forget the exact number, but a huge part of the population just records waking up hungry in the day or not having enough food for more than two meals. Last summer, they had this escalate to the point where, like with clashes with the police, protest against the government. There was even concern that the military was going to split in half and start a civil war. But 150 people died. Those protests have died down a little bit since then, but the underlying tension is still there and they could flare up at any time. But what's probably most shocking is I could say that 4 million Venezuelans have fled the country, mostly to Colombia and Brazil, but also to some other nations. And they've had a couple of security experts that we'll quote on an article that we're getting ready to go up on thetrumpet.com mentioned that this is approaching the levels of Syria's migrant crisis and actually may soon exceed it in the fact that there's been about 5 million people that have fled from Syria due to their civil war. So obviously Syria's death toll has been a lot higher because it actually has broken into civil war. Venezuela hasn't yet.
But in terms of the extent of the migrant crisis,
but in terms of the migrant crisis, you're like 4 million compared to 5 million, and Venezuela.
Where are they going?
Mostly into Colombia, some into Brazil, a few up into Panama or Central America. And that is one concern that the CIA director made, Mike Pompeo, made earlier this year, is that the Venezuelan government's been giving arms to civilian militias to fight on their behalf. A lot of these militias have ties to some terrorist organizations or some drug cartels, so it's hard to say where these arms are ending up. They could very well be going with the migrants into Colombia and into Brazil or even into Panama. As soon as you hook up with Mexican drug cartel, could spike all the way up into the United States. And so this is like this huge humanitarian crisis, almost like a time bomb that's already had devastating consequences in Venezuela. Probably pretty soon we'll have some serious consequences on Brazil and Colombia. And depending on how bad it gets, could even spread all the way up into the U.S. with some of these weapons and migrant flows.
So if you look at the extent of the problems that have resulted from the crisis in Syria and you look at how much that's affected Europe, I mean, really you're looking at the possibility of similar types of problems coming upon the nations around there. Although I guess we don't tend to think of the people of Venezuela as being quite influenced by extremist ideology. Some of the people who were coming out of Syria, among them you had people who were intent on doing damage to Europe, who were radicalized individuals. Maybe with the extent of influence that the drug cartels have there, you'd have a certain amount of that as well?
You'd be surprised in the fact that, yes, the average Venezuelan just who can't get food isn't not normally the type of threat you'd think is someone from coming from a more radicalized environment in Syria. But the current vice president of Venezuela has very close connections with Hezbollah, had a role in forging passports to bring Hezbollah agents from Lebanon into Venezuela to help with the drug trafficking into the United States. It's a Hezbollah project they use to raise money from American drug addicts to finance terrorism in the Middle East. Hmm. And so they're definitely a minority in Venezuela, but there is definitely a very violent minority of Islamic extremists and drug cartel agents that are working together in the American drug trade, that as this crisis spreads, could create the types of chaos that could help make it easier for them to make the journey across all the patchwork of nations throughout Central America towards the United States.
Pretty amazing. We appreciate you bringing our attention to that. Go check out Andrew's article, Venezuela's Migrant Crisis Could Soon Eclipse Syria's Catastrophe. That's on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate that, Andrew. Over to Asia now. We're tracking the movement of America's ally, the Philippines, away from the U.S. and toward China. For the latest on this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, yesterday, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte said that some Philippine troops should go to China to be trained by the People's Liberation Army. And then on Monday, Mr. Duterte was attending a conference of Filipino and Chinese businessmen, and he joked that he hopes China will make the Philippines into a Chinese province. So he was being a little playful there, not entirely serious, I'm sure, but then he also spoke about China's militarized artificial islands in the South China Sea, and he basically said he feels sure that China wants these islands to be able to stand up to America and not as a launching pad to invade the Philippines, and so he's okay with them for that reason. And then what was really interesting is that he neglected to say anything about China's recent decision to unilaterally name and register five undersea features at the Philippine Rias. These are in an area that's not disputed by anyone. These are strictly and definitely in Philippine territory. And yet China has just decided to give these features Chinese names and registration, which could be a prelude to China making some kind of a territorial claim to this part of the Philippines. But Duterte was silent about that. So these kinds of pro-China statements and omissions have just delighted the Chinese who are present at these meetings and the leadership back in Beijing. And it's really just the latest of many statements and actions that Mr. Duterte has taken to kind of show that he would love to see the Philippines shift toward China.
We were talking earlier in the program about Japan making a similar kind of move, in a sense, a bit of daylight between Japan and the United States. We're seeing it here with the Philippines, probably in a more dramatic way in some sense. What do you make of the shift in alliance from the Philippines away from the United States to China?
Well, it's really interesting because the Philippines has been one of America's most loyal allies for decades. But ever since Mr. Duterte came into office back in June of 2016, he's really made no effort to conceal just how eager he is to realign it and to end that alliance. He's canceled a lot of joint Philippine-U.S. patrol drills, some of which were designed just to monitor Chinese action around the Philippines. He's canceled some major joint military exercises between the Philippine and U.S. militaries. At one point, he even announced his country's separation from the U.S. And later, under pressure from some of the top brass in the Philippine military, he partly backed away from that statement. But it is clear that if it were up to him, the Philippines would totally realign and just be no longer dependent on its relationship with the U.S., and instead allied with China.
Well, you can go to thetrumpet.com and look at that booklet we referenced earlier, Russia and China in Prophecy. It really does show how we're expecting, according to the prophecies of the Bible, a realignment of these Asian powers into a single bloc, and the Philippines movement in that direction certainly does fulfill that prophecy, and we're seeing this happen before our eyes. Go check it out, Russia and China in Prophecy, on thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Jeremiah. We've been talking about the drums of war beating in the Middle East between Israel and Iran. This week, the UN Secretary General weighed in on the issue. For this, we'll go back to Anthony Chibatawe.
Secretary General Antonio Guterres of the United Nations, he's concerned about war between Israel and Iran, and it's coming on the heels of this latest clash between these two countries, where this Iranian drone gets into Israeli territory, it's shot down, and Israel attacks Iranian bases in Syria, and Israel is hit back. So just on the heels of that, the Secretary General just came out and say he's really worried about a clash coming. This is what he said. I'm deeply worried about hard to foresee escalations in the whole region. A little later, he said the worst nightmare scenario would be if there is a direct confrontation between Israel and Hezbollah. The level of destruction in Lebanon would be absolutely devastating. So there are major points of concern around this situation. And of course, Hezbollah is Iran's terrorist proxy in Lebanon.
So he specifically says, even though you've got, 15,000 missiles, something to that effect, owned by Hezbollah in Lebanon, what he's concerned about is the level of destruction in Lebanon.
Surprisingly, I won't blame
you. Surprisingly, if you've never read another story about the United Nations.
Yes, but I don't blame him for being concerned about what this crisis. The problem, though, is what he attributes would be the likely cause of this crisis. And I think that's where he gets very dangerously misleading. This is what he said. He said that both sides have shown that they have a willingness to not allow this crisis to occur, which certainly is not true. He also said this, quote, sometimes a spark is enough to unleash this kind of conflict. So in other words, this could all happen accidentally.
I guess by a spark, he's not talking about Iran sending a drone into Israeli airspace.
No, he's not, because we have an article from the Tablet magazine that talks about Guterres' warnings and concerns and his comments. And this article, it also talks about the International Crisis Group, which essentially echoes the same sentiments. And this is a group that offers policy recommendations. And it also warned that this war is something that no one wants and could only be a miscalculation away. So this article in the Tablet is just explaining that and reminding people that, look, we have people in this region who are determined to attack Israel, to create this crisis. Mm-hmm. This is not going to happen by accident. This is not going to happen because someone just crosses the border by accident, or some drone crosses the border by accident, or anything like that. We have a terrorist group that is determined to destroy Israel. He has a quote in here that says, Hezbollah, Iran and their allies are consciously and progressively choosing to degrade Israel's qualitative military edge to the point where Israel will have to choose between a preemptive strike leading to a wide-scale war or one of several non-war options. At least some Israelis believe are available to it. So I think the main point here is just the importance of informing our listeners that a war in Israel between Israel and Hezbollah will not happen by accident. In fact, the title of this article is The Next Israel-Hezbollah War Won't Be an Accident. And that certainly is true because of what the Bible talks about, that clash that will divide Jerusalem in half.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We'll go ahead and put a link to the Jerusalem and Prophecy booklet in the show notes for the program today. That's going to do it. Appreciate that, Anthony. For today's Trumpet Hour, visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for the links to the articles and the literature we discussed on the program today. You can let us know what you thought of the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to the gentlemen on this distinguished panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibatterway, and Richard Palmer.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Samuel Adams. A general dissolution of principles and manners will more surely overthrow the liberties of America than the whole force of the common enemy. While the people are virtuous, they cannot be subdued. But when once they lose their virtue, then will they be ready to surrender their liberties to the first external or internal invader. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.